All right, you're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I am Adam Rappaport. On today's show, we've got our old friend, editor-at-large, Andrew Knowlton, stopping by from his new home in Austin, Texas. Andrew spent 18 years at Bon Appetit, many of them traveling the country and critiquing restaurants from coast to coast. And, well, he just opened up a restaurant, or at least helped open a restaurant, the Carpenter's Hall at the Carpenter Hotel in Austin, Texas. And I don't know, I wanted to catch up with Knowlton and ask him what it's like to be on the receiving end of all that criticism now, and what it's like actually running a restaurant. But he didn't just open a restaurant. As you may know, Knowlton is also the host of The Final Table, the new Netflix cooking competition show. So I talked to him about that as well. And after that, I talked to David Tamarkin, editor of BA's sister site, Epicurious, about his new cookbook, Cook 90, which he started a few years ago as a cooking challenge on Epicurious.com, in which Tamarkin, for some reason, crazy guy that he is, set out to cook 3 meals a day for 30 straight days. And now it's a cookbook. All right, let's do this. Here is Andrew Knowlton. Knowlton, so how is life on the outside?
It's different. I will say the holidays quite aren't the same, because I've been, you know, usually when you have a 9-to-5 or whatever job, we have a place to be every day. You look forward to the holidays, and when it's all kind of, I'm not saying it's a holiday, but the difference between working and not working, it's kind of, it all blends together.
Yeah. Well, especially where when you work in restaurants, as any sort of industry professional will tell you, like, oh yeah, like Tuesday, Wednesday are my weekend. That sort of thing. Like,
right.
The weekends aren't the weekends.
Right.
The schedule kind of, yeah, just the weeks and days just kind of bleed together.
But none of this was intentional. Like, I had no idea when I got involved in a hotel and restaurant that I wasn't supposed to be there. Like, I was supposed to like help recruit a chef and work with the staff and give my opinion to anybody who would listen. But like anything that you care about, it's hard to remove myself from just the daily, like being on the floor.
Yeah, because you're like, you're the one who probably notices the details more than anyone else.
And it kills me.
And it's all in the details. I
told my wife the other day, the only person that it would probably bother worse than it bothers me is you. Because
yeah.
There's constant lighting issues. There's music issues. The bane of any restaurant, especially front of the house, is marking. Do you know what marking is?
No, what's marking?
Marking is when you mark your tables. After you clear, let's say, an app, and you take their silverware away, you have to mark their tables for the next course.
Wait, so how do you do that? What do you mean? So
you mark with you. It's just a phrase. That's when you put the next utensils down for the next, like,
oh, okay.
When your entree.
Yeah.
So position one is having steak. You know you need to give them silverware, and because that person's having a steak, they get a steak knife. Or if you're at a fancy restaurant, you get a fish.
Yeah, fish knife or a spoon if there's soup
and,
coming.
And waiters, most servers do not, they refuse to mark their tables. So what's the worst thing is when you deliver food to a table and they don't have silverware.
Yeah, and you're like, thanks, but I don't have a knife for my steak. And then you're sitting there staring at the steak and you can't just pick it up
and
like
a
burger.
It is the most awkward moment in a restaurant. There's no other thing that can make the record just like,
okay, so, all right. So you spent 18 years at Bon Appetit. No, dude, 18 years. You spent literally a lifetime at this one magazine.
I know.
That's insane. Okay. And then you're segueing. You're like, I got to get out.
I didn't say I got to get out. I was just like, it felt like.
There were many nights at like Prime Meats or whatever, Brooklyn, where you probably said those exact words.
Yes.
Over a whiskey.
Well, I never got to be you at the top. So I was like, well, Rappo's not going anywhere. So what am I going to do?
Who knows? So this notion of the guys who run the Carpenter, who are.
So I got involved with a group called the Mighty Union, which my wife is a part of, and then 3 other people who have had their hands in a few other hotels, including the original Ace Portland, which they still are a part of. And they have a place in Oregon outside of Portland called Subtle Lodge. And they wanted to get involved and do a number of hotels. So the first property is called the Carpenter, which is an old Carpenters Union in Austin, Texas, just behind a P. Terry's on South Lamar, right near Lady Bird Lake. And they kind of brought my wife and I on to do the F&B for this hotel and a hotel that's opening in San Antonio and one that's opening in Honolulu.
Okay, first question. So our friend from the Ace Portland.
Donald Kenny.
He's involved, right?
He is. He's more of the, I would say, we're all involved, but he's more of the hotel side of things. Okay. He knows how to run a hotel.
Okay, so Donald, who is also one of these persons, if you're ever in the Ace Portland, as for Donald, who is a man of details. He appreciates the small things. He gets it right. He's on top of it.
Notices everything. He's the consummate. He's about hospitality.
Yeah. Did he think to himself, like, I know how to run a hotel. I have opinions on restaurants, but I'm not the day-to-day person to oversee the launch of a restaurant.
Right. I think I traveled a lot with him because every time I would go to Portland or even Seattle or he would come to New York, like, he was a great eating buddy. Like, he can eat hardcore. And I think he saw somebody in me that he saw himself on the hotel side. Okay. So I was the restaurant equivalent.
All right, so a good compliment to him. So when you guys talked about, would you come on to do this, what did you think the scope of the job was going to be? And what did you think your most sort of important contribution to getting this restaurant open would be?
You know, it's easy to say, like, oh, just because I've been to a lot of restaurants, that means I can run a restaurant. Like, that's totally not true.
But you can criticize people for trying to run a restaurant. Yeah.
You should talk to the people I work with now. That sounds like me. No, I think I notice things and I know what the ingredients are that go into a successful restaurant. I know the things that I like in a restaurant, and I think that makes for a good restaurant. And so my job was to come in and help develop a team. Front of the house, back of the house team at the restaurant, whether that's getting somebody from San Francisco to move or getting a chef who used to be in Minneapolis, who was previously in Austin, to come back. So just building a team.
Get the talent first.
Get the talent and then work with Chef Gray Nonis, who used to be at a place called Olame in Austin. Mm-hmm. And then he went for a short time to Minneapolis and he's come back to open the Carpenter's Hall, to work with him on the menu, just to give my two cents. It's his baby, but I'm just a sounding board. I mean, he says it's the worst career choice that he's ever made, just like that the person that he is consulting with on the menu is me.
Yeah. But it's interesting. So chefs, as like, I guess it's how your position might be, if we're going to bring it back to publishing, you're kind of the editor. And if he's the writer, it seems like you're the one who says, this is good, but how about we also add this or we take away that?
Right.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think there's, like, why is this that way? Or I think it's more to ask questions rather than to be, say, like, change this, do that. It's more like, why are you using that Green Goddess on that and not on something else?
But you also bring, as someone who's eaten around a lot, understands the ingredient, the formula for a successful restaurant. I imagine you also said to him, like, all right, listen, we need a really good club sandwich on the menu. Everyone's doing some version of schnitzel or panko crusted katsu. We should really have a cutlet somewhere on the menu.
Right.
We should have some sort of Cobb sort of niçoise salad. Is that fair to say? Is that kind of how
you
approach the menu?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a double thing because we are not, there's no concept behind the Carpenter's Hall. It's not like, oh, that's a Thai place or that's an Italian place. And sometimes when it's more of a kind of, you can't put your finger on what the restaurant is. That sometimes is hard for people to relate to. It's just kind of like an American restaurant that draws influences from all over. It's a Hillstone or a Houston, if you will, which is not a bad model for any restaurant.
All right, so a couple of things. You can check out Andrew's, if you listen now, go on to Instagram to Andrew O. Knowlton, correct?
Right. That's right.
And you can see a lot of photos of the dishes that you guys developed for the restaurant. You could also read Andrew's brilliant piece on Hillstone and bonappetit.com. But I think what strikes me about the restaurant is that, and I mean this in a good way.
You never mean it that way when you have to say
it. It's more of a greatest hits album than I don't want to say concept album, but just a one album with one point of view. Because like I said, there is a lot of, oh, I want to eat that. I want the chicken payar, the crunchy rice and quinoa bowl. You've got, I'm just reading off the menu, the lunch menu now, the vaquero bean dip with sesame crackers. You have like the smash burger. It's all gooey with American cheese and great bun and whatnot. You know, there's a lot of sort of hits in the way that Hillstone does that, where you see it on the menu, And the first thing you think is, oh, I want to order that. But I also want to order that. Ooh, and I might want to get that.
Yeah, I think the one thing I learned from eating out is that the older I got and the more I ate out is I liked the simplicity in cooking. And I think everybody, if you look at cookbook authors, the books that they produce later in life are always the most simple. Like yeah. whether it's Richard Olney, like yeah. his seminal book was Simple French Food, or Alice Waters, or you know, any of these writers, it goes back to the roots of like cooking. And I think that's what Gray and I wanted to do with the menu, is like not hide behind, you know, micro flowers or micro herbs, or just not do anything that we thought people wanted us to do, but just to cook the food that we wanted to eat. I know that's a cliche
yeah, but,
now.
But, all right, but did he, or were you like, dude, no, you need to rein that in, Ben. I know you're a chef and that you can know how to do this, but that's one notch too far.
I will say that Gray's been, I can't imagine any other chef.
Careful, he might be listening.
No, I know. I can't imagine any other chef being as gracious and open to teamwork as he is, because many great chefs are egoists. I mean, that's what makes them great.
Yeah, the good one, they're committed. So let me ask you this. Name one instance in which you stuck to your guns and you think you're right, and one instance where he stuck to his guns on a dish.
Well, we're kind of going through that right now with a few dishes. No, I mean,
like,
I think...
Give me some examples.
Well, there was a fish dish on...
See, there's your first mistake.
You don't like fish. Well, neither does Texas.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless it's fried, yeah. and it starts with red and ends in snapper. No, I think it wasn't specific dishes. It was more plating. I think... He had a tendency, and I've told them this, I think any chef had a tendency to overplate food.
Yeah.
And it just didn't come across as, I think, the way that we ended up wanting it to. And I will say a lot of the things that we talked about was on Instagram. Like, I would look at specific dishes on Instagram, and I'm like, it doesn't have to be as stark as, you know, Lyle's in London, or even like an Estella in New York, or Altro mm-hmm. Paradiso, but it needed to just let it be, you know.
Well, and I noticed that, and Instagram's an interesting barometer. I talk about it a lot at work in terms of the dishes we develop. Is that what I like about Instagram as a sort of litmus test? Is that the reaction is immediate, because yeah. as you're scrolling through, either you stop or you don't.
That's right.
And like, I love like your schnitzel shot on Instagram. Beautiful crispy cutlet with that cool black garlic chimichurri on it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it.
Yeah.
You're like, boom, I get that.
And we went with a smaller plate. Like yeah. we were going back and forth on the size of the plate. This is the kind of thing you think about yeah. when you're opening restaurants. Like,
don't think about it when you're going to a restaurant.
You don't care. But when you get that smaller plate and you get the schnitzel, which is a half a chicken that's boned and then flattened out, when that thing is hanging off the side, you have that reaction like you know, if you've ever been to Berlin or Frankfurt and seeing those huge schnitzels.
Yeah, yeah.
We wanted that reaction. And I think that's something you think about when you're opening a restaurant, is just like you would with Instagram, is like the minute it hits your plate, it's hard not to like something that looks good.
Yeah.
That you're like, oh, I want to eat that. And it's like we've struggled with the club sandwich, which sounds silly. Like, it's a hard thing to plate because we don't want to slice it into fours, because I feel like sometimes it can be difficult to eat in
all
fours.
Right, well, okay, first of all, you're wrong. A club sandwich has to be cut in fours.
That's what makes it a club sandwich.
You need toothpicks. It needs to be in fours.
There's toothpicks.
That's what makes it a club
sandwich. There's frilly toothpicks.
Otherwise, it's like a Dagwood or something.
No, because I think as long as the eating sensation itself is the same and you get that same visceral, like there's triangles to eat, like you're eating the side. I've done the experiment.
It's not triangles. You're eating a half. Well, I guess it's a technical triangle if you cut
it
on the...
It is the triangle. It is a triangle. It's just two triangles.
What kind of bread are you even using for that?
We're using the most magical bread on the planet, which Bon Appetit, I think, is doing a feature on, called Japanese milk bread.
Japanese milk bread.
Which
yes.
Gray got the recipe from his wife's family. She's Japanese. And it is the lightest, fluffiest. It's almost like a cross between crappy American white bread and delicious brioche. It's not as like... buttery and rich as a brioche, but it has that same kind of pliability, and like you can literally take a loaf of Japanese milk bread and smash it down till it's like flat like a piece of paper, and then it'll just like puff back up. It's
all
pretty
right.
Amazing.
So I'm looking at the photo online on the Insta. What kind of mayonnaise?
Hellman's.
All right. Well, I don't know if like Texas is a Duke's state or not.
No. Well, only one of two things that we don't make in house.
Okay. You have the frilly toothpicks in there, which
absolutely.
I like.
Absolutely. That, see, that's a non... You can't mess with that.
Do you roast your own turkey breast?
We do.
And
we
then,
do.
And then you shave it on a slicer?
Yes, okay. We do. Same thing with a roast beef sandwich.
And then what about the bacon?
The bacon is from Oklahoma. It's just, we don't cure our own bacon.
Yeah,
but yes.
Well, I know that, but I'm saying, do you have thoughts like on how thick it should be? Do you want, like, you know what I mean? Like that sort of...
Well, we went... It should be thicker than you think because I don't like more than one piece kind of stacked on top of each other, because then I think bacon is one thing that can overwhelm a club sandwich. Yeah. And I think the point of a club sandwich is the mayo first, the crispy bread, and then the turkey. Have you seen the club sandwiches where every stratification of the sandwich is the exact same thickness? So the bread is the same.
That's what I mean. Because in Europe, they use that really thin white bread.
Yes, right.
How often do people not want the middle slice of bread?
The soaker slice, as we call it.
Oh, see, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the soaker slice. Not often, but I think what you'll see people do is they, which is a little disturbing, is they'll make two sandwiches out of it. So they'll take the, you know, it's like basically two sandwiches stacked on each other, but there's no double piece of bread in the middle. So one they'll eat like open faced, and the other one making
Who
a sandwich.
Are these people?
People, if you watch people eat food, they're really weird. Like some people dissect it. Some people, like if they see something brown, like you, if there's a mushroom in something, people freak out. I'm not knocking the customers that come in, but I had no idea. I really didn't. I had no idea that the substitutions and the intolerances and the allergies had gotten to this point in the United States of America. Every ticket that comes through
has like a red
thing that's, you know, no peanuts, no soy. I mean, did you see Ignacio from Outro Paradiso the other day posted on Instagram a receipt because Michelle Obama came into Outro Paradiso the other night? And the ticket, I don't know who was the actual diner, the ticket was littered with, like, go look it up. It's 10, 15 allergies.
From people in her party.
Yeah. It was
outrageous. Is there anything you guys won't buck on? Or?
Well, I feel like that's probably a contentious point between the front of the house and the back of the house, is I would say Chef, rightfully so, like, sticks to his guns and says, like, no, like, I'm not. I'll do that. I'm
but
not
what?
Doing
Give me
that.
An example.
Well, I think there's the club sandwich is a huge thing. He will not budge on that anymore. Like if you don't want tomatoes, he'll take that out. But he's not going to substitute yellow mustard or whatever. Animal style burgers, like that people come in and want our griddle burger wrapped in iceberg lettuce. Like that's a normal request now. He will not do that. He will not do that.
And then do people get in a huff and walk out, or are they just like, okay, whatever, I'll order something else?
I mean, we try to accommodate it. I mean, they don't walk out, but somebody else is doing it. I mean, we had this pappardelle with mushrooms.
Which looks also quite good.
Lion's mane mushrooms, like golden oyster mushrooms, and it had shiitakes, and a woman said she didn't eat shiitakes, but she would eat the other mushrooms. So
what?
Yeah, so... Can we take the shiitakes out? And that was already kind of like it had been made into a ragu of sorts.
Yeah.
So it's just, I think...
You know what I think? I think like there's a school of being a public figure or being a restaurant. So there's that sort of school of like thought of either being Charles Barkley or David Chang, where you just come out from the beginning and say like, hey,
no,
this is what I'm doing. Yeah. If you don't like it, take your business somewhere else. Don't listen to me. Screw off. But like, this is how I operate. Deal with it.
But if you
accommodate in the beginning, then you're gonna always be accommodating.
I think it's also people feel more comfortable at a hotel restaurant.
Yeah,
if you will,
requesting.
Talk about that.
Talk about. So you're the Carpenter's Hall restaurant is in the Carpenter Hotel.
Yes.
How does operating a restaurant within a hotel differ?
It's a 24/7 thing, right? Because we open at 7 a.m. for breakfast. Last ticket goes out at midnight, but the bar stays open till 2. We have a cafe that is open most of the day. So that's something that I think chefs had a hard time, is there's no time to reset. You're always open. Like when you have pre-shift meeting, which is when the waiters and the staff meets before you, the customer comes in and says who the VIPs are, who the special is, that's happening in the dining room while there might be people seated there because we have no place to go. It's just, you know, this operation
always
that's all the time. But I do think, and breakfast, you know, I hear your voice in my head a lot when like people are like,
rah, rah, rah.
It's not salty enough, or yeah. You know, breakfast is the hardest because people expect breakfast to be exactly the way that they would make it at home.
Definitely the most particular.
Particular. Eggs are the yeah. bane of every hotel chef's existence. Yeah. It is hard to cook eggs the way that every single person wants their eggs.
Yeah, it's like, I want it sunny side up, but I don't want that weird little film right. over the yolks.
And we're trying to explain the way that it seems like the staff at BA eats their eggs is that kind of Spanish style, that like hard fry in yeah. olive oil, but still, it's hard to tell people, like, if they'd have never done that, how to do that.
Do you say, do you explain them as crispy eggs?
We call them on the breakfast menu with the barbacoa.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we call them Spanish style.
Best-selling item on the menu so far?
Dinner, it's the schnitzel. It's yeah. definitely the schnitzel. And the caviar with the potato chips. So we have Oklahoma caviar, which is delicious farm-raised caviar, fairly priced. And then
sort of fish is it from?
It's from Hackleback.
Hmm.
And you get an ounce of it, and it comes with a bag, literally a small bag of Ruffles potato chips.
See, that's like a clever concept-y thing that seems like someone like you who's been around and eaten a lot and taken notes would think of in a smart branding way more than a chef who has a vision.
Well, that was one of the debates. It wasn't necessarily with Gray because I think he was into it, but people, when they first saw the bag of Ruffles going out, were like, why aren't we making our own potato chips, which yeah. I hate homemade potato chips.
That's like saying, why aren't we making our own Fritos for the right. Frito pie? It's like, right. no, it's not how it works.
So we just put the bag, and it's been the number one thing that I don't care about Instagram moments or yeah. anything, but people like Instagram.
But there's
that.
Also those certain dishes, which I'm sure you thought about, where people see going by when a waiter's delivering it to another table, and they're like, oh, what's that?
Exactly. That and the schnitzel, like people yeah. see that and like, I want that.
What's a dish you've had to take off the menu because it just hasn't worked?
Well, we're only a month and a half in, so we've tried to like dig our feet in and see how things will go over time. We did have a crispy Norwegian waffle, so it was like a heart-shaped waffle that came with the bean dip, and that just people didn't understand how to eat that. They see like a waffle and
let's just interrupt that. Andrew's wife is from Norway. That one's a little too close to home. It was too close to your heart that, you know, you needed to recuse yourself from that decision.
I did.
Process.
It had to come off. I mean, there's been some tweaks and all that. But we stayed true to what we have going right now.
In terms of, I would think managing people has to be a challenge, maybe even more so than managing a menu. Fair?
Absolutely.
Have you had to fire anyone yet?
Me personally, no. You know, I think with any new opening, you have people that work out, or maybe they're not happy, or, you know, the hard thing is you servers need to make money. And if you know, Austin, Texas is a wonderful food city, but it's not New York City in terms of like the minute you open. There's like 10 different media mentions and yeah. people are banging at the door. So it's been like, and that's good because we've had time to get up to speed. But now that we're doing 150 covers a night, you know, I think you get the good servers from the ones who perhaps haven't had that experience yet is the big difference. I mean, you hear David Chang and you hear, you know, Missy Robbins or whomever it is complain about staffing. It's like, it's really hard to get. It's not hard to get cooks. It's hard to get good cooks who are passionate about what's going on as you. It's just like yeah. anything, you know.
Yeah. But it's also like you expect people to care as much as you, but you're like,
hard.
But you're paying them $13 an hour. And yeah. It's not their restaurant. Why should
and
they care
trying
as
to
much
pay
as
rent
you?
And like when I'm breathing down somebody's neck, being like, why don't you know what stracciatella is? Like I have to take a step back and be like, not everyone yeah. works at a magazine for 18 years about food. I mean. That to go back to where we started, that's the hardest part is like, I'm a restaurant junkie, whether it's eating in them or, you know, I worked at one where I met my wife way back when in Brooklyn. But like, that's the hardest thing for me is to remove myself from the floor. I don't really do anything except just watch tables and freak out. And you have to be able to pick, you can't nitpick people constantly. Like you have to, you can't just constantly berate people
yeah.
and you have to take a step back and decide when you do that. And then the other thing that's really taxing is you notice everything. You notice everything when you make a magazine or when you're remodeling a house, but the consumer, the guest doesn't recognize that stuff. So deciding what matters the most to them.
What's the breakdown of revenue from alcohol to food?
Well, it's, we're so new, and we're also a hotel restaurant, so people drink at
like,
a hotel
what are they drinking?
Restaurant.
Like,
they love, like, cocktails.
Cocktails.
They love, I mean, one of the things that will ruin Austin, Texas as a food city is the allegiance to the margarita in that town.
I was going to say, must be, do you have to have, like, specialty margaritas
no.
on the menu?
No. They people just want a shit ton of margaritas.
And they don't need to be, like, cranberry
nope.
or
nope.
pomegranate margaritas? Nope. Yeah, just give me a margarita. Rocks, salt.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know what the equivalent in New York would be, maybe a martini, but it's yeah. like, I can just sit at the bar sometimes and hear the margaritas. It's not on the menu. Like, we don't put it on the menu because we don't have to.
So you have to just squeeze a hell of a lot of limes every day?
Yeah, I mean, we're ready for it. Yeah. I mean, we do a Tommy-style margarita, which is
means what?
No triple sec mm-hmm. and no Cointreau. It's just agave syrup. Lime, a little simple syrup, and then tequila.
Why do you use simple syrup and agave syrup?
Just a little bit.
Uh-huh. But yeah. you can't just do as agave?
I think sometimes it's a little rich. Mm-hmm. I think you need a little bit of sweetness, little more sweetness.
What's your rail tequila for a basic margarita?
Tapatio.
Okay. You asking me or telling me?
No, I'm telling you.
Okay.
I was asking, like, have you heard of that?
Yeah. No. Okay. But I don't live in Texas. Do they do the natural wine thing down there?
Our wine list, which I had a big hand in, is almost all natural wine.
How's that going over?
It's okay sometimes. It's a battle. You get bottles or glasses sent back that there's something wrong with this wine or it's funky. And, you know, I get it.
They just want, like, a Napa cab.
You know, I that's not just Texas. That's
yeah.
everywhere.
Yes.
You know, walking up, I want a Merlot or Chardonnay. And that's where, you know, you have to have good servers who can, you know, certainly not respect those requests and say, like, hey, we don't have that, but we have this.
Try this.
But it is hard because you don't, the other rule is if you, by the time somebody walks into a restaurant and you've said no to them like four times already,
yeah.
like, oh, do you have this vodka? No. Do you have a Merlot? No.
No.
You know, do
yeah.
you, can
wow,
you, can
God.
You put, can you put mustard on my club? No. And already you've lost them.
Yeah.
You can't
say no. But that's what's so
no
hard
because
you want a point of view, you want to, identity.
Right.
But then you don't want to, you're not actively trying to piss off the customer.
But I think you have to gain people's trust. It's like Balthazar in New York. Like people go in there and have their issues too. But like once you create a restaurant that people are happy to be in and the vibe and they become They kind of succumb to the allure of
yes,
that restaurant.
Like, sure, I'll try snails.
Right. And that's what I've always said about why I've had a lot of good meals is because I met that restaurant halfway. Like for 2 hours of my life, I left all the things that my prejudices or my likes or my dislikes at the door, and I give myself to that restaurant. And if they take me to a cool place, then I like that place. And if they don't, or there's no vision of where they're
yeah.
taking me. So that's why... Like, I don't like customers or anybody who comes in and is like, oh, this isn't like the other place. Well, because it's not. This is...
Yeah, I hope not.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. You also, you moved to Texas. You decided to open a restaurant. You also are on a television show.
I am, yeah.
The Final Table.
The Final Table. Can't even say that out loud anymore.
Debuted on Netflix about a month ago?
Yeah, November. I think it was just the beginning of November.
It came on. Now, do people come up to you at the restaurant? Like, hey, are you the guy from The Final Table?
I get that like F-level celebrity where it's like, I know you from somewhere. have we met before? And I'm like... No. And then like they come back like 5 minutes later and like, you're that guy who wears the pocket.
All right. So Final Table, if you haven't watched it, big time food competition show. I have some questions. We'll not spend too much time. But yeah. So how'd the wardrobe situation go?
Well, they had a stylist who we went through multiple suits and pocket squares.
Was a pocket square like that had to be a thing? Like we're doing a pocket square?
I think it became
suit?
A thing.
Uh-huh.
It became a thing. As well as these little buttons that were on here. They weren't American flags, but they were just little, I don't know if you even saw those little buttons.
Oh, like a lapel pin, you mean?
Yeah. But
yeah.
It wasn't like, it
yeah.
wasn't a flag or
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
It was like just a design. Well, what did you think of the wardrobe, Mr. GQ?
It was bold. I will personally, I'm not a... I like a pocket square. I'm more of the square fold than the poofy.
I see that, yes.
Sort of thing.
Right.
You know, going more Don Draper than
right. Than more
know,
than
Robert Goulet right. or someone.
I definitely think there's a Because I had the same reaction, like they put me in this like bright blue, like look like more of a Steve Harvey type suit.
Oh yes,
and they're like, no, it looks really good on camera.
I will say this though, Steve Harvey much sharper these days. Like I remember when I was at GQ and I'd go to Magic, the men's apparel showcase thing in Vegas, and his suit line was always there. And this was like, oh, all right, sure, 8, 9, 10 years ago, but they were always like 5, 6 button suits and like very zoot suity. And now like Steve's looking sharp. I don't know if you've noticed that.
He has his own line.
That's what I'm saying. I used to go there and it was his line, but now it's very like almost Tom Ford. Like he's on TV with his black suit and white shirt and black tie.
And his mustache. Did he shave his mustache?
I don't know, but I think, yeah. Harvey's looking good.
But there's definitely that like TV host look that you have to be a little bit bright and flashy, which would not be my date, as you know me, my day-to-day thing.
So they said you can't just wear a baseball hat and shorts?
No, that wouldn't work.
Yeah, you're on TV. When you walked on set for the first time, were you like, holy shit, this is like a serious, like the set itself, the scope and scale of it.
I would say I've never been more petrified in my life. I felt like I was in like the second grade, like holiday sing, where somebody's like, oh, you have to do a solo or something and walk out on stage and you see everybody out there.
Because it's funny when I did that show on Food Network a couple years ago, Best Baker in America. It feels like your show is set like at Cowboys AT&T Stadium, whereas like mine is like in that soccer stadium that the Los Angeles Chargers play in.
Yes. I mean, I think, and also like—
And that's a fine stadium, but it says, yeah.
With all due respect to myself, I think I was, that first episode, like I was a deer in headlights, and I looked that way. I think I got more natural just having, because it was a huge, I mean, before we filmed there, which is in Culver City in L.A., they just got done filming like a Star Trek sequel. That's like what kind of set it was.
Big hangar, airplane hangar, essentially.
And people have kind of, I think, made fun of it a little bit along. Like it looks like Battlestar Galactica, like the lights.
How do you, all right, so you've done a lot of press for the show over the last several weeks. What is your most sort of like, what's your go-to succinct description of what the show is?
I think it's a global competition that instead of putting chefs up to fail, it puts them up to succeed.
Ooh.
And I think it has integrity and earnestness, and hopefully it's entertaining at the same time for people. But, you know, it's showing chefs at their best.
I think at one point you described it, I think early on, you, in a comparison, you invoked the World Cup.
A little bit, I mean, I wish there's some things I think, you know, for the second season that hopefully will be even more dynamic with the competitors.
Yeah.
Perhaps figure a few things out in terms of pacing and all that. But it's also like the diversity of it. And so to truly be a World Cup, it needs to be inclusive. But you only have so many competitors. And, you know, it's tough sometimes to get chefs to do these competition shows because they're all a little bit, you know, skeptical of the big, you know. And they have to leave their restaurants for a month at a time.
Yeah,
like
it's a
big ask.
Yeah. All right, we're gonna let you go, Knowlton. Season 2, that's happening.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
likely.
It's likely. It's just a matter of when, rather, you know.
Yeah. So there's no film dates yet.
Not that I can reveal.
And if it does, assume it does happen, it will be a Netflix thing where it's all dropped at once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that was that's the big thing for a reality show. Unscripted show is like, how do you drop it all at once? Are people going to skip to the end and, like I've said, like see the shark get blown up at the end? No, hopefully you'll stick with it.
All right, we're going to do a quick lightning round.
I love the lightning. That's the only reason I do this podcast, so I can do lightning rounds.
Lone Star or Tecate?
Tecate.
With a lime?
Yeah.
All right.
But can I just say, it has to be a tall boy, Tecate. Everything's tall in Texas.
Yeah, can. Okay, cool. Host or judge?
Host. Judging's too hard, and I have a tendency to be kind of a dick at times, and the judging just brings it out of me.
And you have to eat a lot.
You have to eat. But I eat everything on set, you know, for the final table.
Lance or McConaughey?
Oh, McConaughey.
So if you could hang with one guy one day and
absolutely, and I will. Like that's my goal in 2019 is to have. I think he's a Wild Turkey spokesman, whiskey. That's my goal. Is to have a drink with him.
You'd rather hang with McConaughey than go cycling with Lance?
I mean, I kind of want to do both, but at the end of the day,
you get one.
At the end of the day, I'm better at drinking than I am at riding a bike.
Okay. We're gonna put that in a pull quote. Migos or breakfast taco?
Can I say I like migas in my breakfast taco?
Oh, yeah. All right. We'll let you have that one. Black beans or pintos?
I'm a black bean guy.
Really?
Yeah. I've been converted. I think when you get really good refried beans, like made properly, the way that Rick Martinez, who used to work in the BA kitchen, like with the lard and all that, they're a magical thing. I didn't realize that until I moved to Texas.
I like a whole pinto, though.
I like them both, but I think with a Tex-Mex is just, it's, I know you know this, but it's the biggest thing in Tex. I mean, it is huge.
Yeah. Party at the Moon Tower or all day at the arcade with unlimited quarters?
Arcade. I will say, though, we went to Zilker Lights, which is this big festival in Zilker Park, which is where they have ACL, the big festival, and there's a huge moon tower there.
Oh, my God.
And they make a tree. They put lights up on the moon tower.
That's
awesome. I put it on my Instagram the other day. So
I
it's a, but you know what? A moon tower just looks like a big radio tower. It's not like a water tower.
What is it for?
I don't really know what a moon tower is, but there's like 10 of them in Austin.
But is there a functional
purpose? Not anymore. I think they're all defunct now. They might be cellular service
towers. But what were they originally?
I don't know.
What was your best game growing up at the arcade?
It was Galaga. I was huge at Galaga.
I like that you can still find Galaga. Barton Springs or Hotel Pool?
You can't beat Barton Springs.
Yeah.
With all the salamanders and all that. It's nice.
Actual salamanders?
Yeah, there's little newts that live in the Barton Spring newt. It's fun. I love that place.
I'm going to put you on the spot on this one. The Carpenter or St. Cecilia?
Why would the Carpenter?
You're saying you'd rather stay at the Carpenter than St. Cecilia?
They're two different experiences. Both are magical.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. All right, I'm just asking you.
The St. Cecilia costs $1,000 a night. The Carpenter doesn't cost
$1,000. I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying if you could say it won.
I think one of the great experiences in Austin, Texas, is to go to the St. Cecilia and have a drink underneath those oak trees. Yeah. It's an amazing time.
And then go back to your room at the Carpenter.
And then go back to the Carpenter and have a griddle burger.
ACL or SXSW? That would be South by Southwest, Austin City Limits.
ACL. I mean, nobody who lives in Austin stays for South by Southwest. It's when spring break is on purpose.
So you literally get out of town.
Everyone leaves town for
Airbnb
South by.
Airbnb your house if you want to?
Yes.
That makes me feel
ACL's real. More of a community thing, I would think.
So if I come down to South by this March, you won't be there?
No.
Really?
No. Everyone's like, you leave. That's when spring break is.
I feel like such a loser. A couple more. Spurs, Mavs, or Rockets?
You know what? I'm a big... The big unit, like I'm a Spurs fan.
Oh no, the big unit was Randy, what's his name? Randy Johnson, pitcher. You're talking Tim Duncan?
Yeah, what's Tim Duncan's nickname?
I don't know if he had a nickname.
Yeah, he did.
Well, the big unit's Randy Johnson, which is the most bizarre nickname ever.
Wait, did I just?
Yeah.
You got to find that out. What that is?
I don't know. Well, you're gonna be converted to Luka Doncic because that guy's the man.
He's good, but I can never root for Dallas Mavericks. I'm sorry.
All right. Tequila or mezcal?
Tequila. Mezcal's too smoky for me sometimes.
Yeah, what's your tequila of choice these days?
Let's say the La Gratona, the one that I just wrote for in the December-January issue of Bon Appetit.
Beautiful green bottle.
Made of recycled Coke bottles.
Yeah.
It's the best. It's the best sipper to me. I don't know. Just like it's a Reposado.
All right. People, you can go hang out with Andrew at Carpenter's Hall in Austin at the Carpenter Hotel, or you can catch up with him on The Final Table. Available now on Netflix, right?
That's right.
All right.
Thanks, Rappo.
Thanks, Andrew. All right. That was Andrew Knowlton, editor at large. And now here is David Tamarkin, editor of Epicurious. David Tamarkin, published author. Welcome back to the pod.
Thank you. That's me. That's the first time anyone's ever said that, actually.
Really?
Well, to my face.
Do you
I'm sure
say it?
Everywhere people are talking about David Tamarkin, published author, but not to my face.
When you get your iced coffee in the morning, do you walk into the coffee place and say?
They say, "What's your name?" And I say, "Published author."
Yeah. David Tamarkin, David Tamarkin.
Cookbook writer, yeah.
How's it going? The book came out, about a month ago?
Yeah, it came out December 11th.
Okay.
Just in time for the holidays.
Yeah.
And just in time for Cook 90, January 1. And yeah, so it's been about a month and it's going amazing. Right? You see it everywhere. NPR.
You did NPR.
I did NPR. Talked to Audie. I'm obsessed with Audie Cornish.
Why?
Obsessed with her. Well, she's obsessed she's obsessed with me. I'm obsessed with her.
What do you mean? She's not. Unusual obsessive society.
She's actually cooked from the book. She told me, like, when she didn't say this on the air. She said a little bit of it on the air, but like,
there's no evidence for actually saying this.
She said there was one recipe that she cooked, and so that was amazing. And I got all like, you know, what is it? Is it
verklempt?
Verklempt. I was like, that's so sweet that you cooked on the air with her. That's so sweet you cooked this recipe. And then interview was over, and she's like, oh, by the way, I also cooked this one and this one and this one. I said, oh my God, you're doing Cook 90. And she said, slow down. I'm not doing. It's day one.
Okay, so I do want to get to the book itself, since it's been published, promotion, all that sort of stuff that you've been doing. But let's talk about the genesis for the idea for Cook 90. How much of this idea was born out of your being an editor who needed to come up with the concept to pitch for Epicurious, because we need to do these sort of things? And how much of this was you as a home cook saying, I need to cook more?
It was 100% not, well, okay, it was 95% not an editorial choice at first, but then the next day it became an editorial choice. But at first it was, I was like, I feel like a sham, like I don't cook enough, and I am the editor of this cooking website, of the world's most trusted and best and biggest cooking website. Mm-hmm. And there were lots of other reasons. I was just like spending a lot of money at the cafeteria here at Condé Nast.
You used to eat there a lot, at the sandwich bar.
Sandwich bar's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, sandwich bar's okay. It's really more about the hard-boiled eggs they have in the morning. You can bounce them like tennis balls. If you ever want to play tennis...
They do overcook the hard-boiled eggs.
We could like play ping pong here at the studio with the eggs. It was about saving money, and it was about wanting to connect with my readers, which is why I say 5% was an editorial choice. I wanted to understand, well, people who do cook all the time... a lot of my readers at Epicurious are just really dedicated home cooks, and they have families, and they're... And I can't really understand a lot of what they go through because I don't have a family. I'm just, it's just me and my boyfriend. And
at the time that this idea took seed, you guys weren't even, you were living alone, correct?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
So I'm just laughing because, we got letters.
the last time we did a podcast?
Well, the last time we talked about this, I got letters from readers saying, oh my God, Adam was so hard on you, and why was he doing that? And these are from strangers, like just coming to my defense. Like he was clearly making you uncomfortable.
Yeah, but now you guys are living together. That's thanks to me.
That's right.
I was forcing the issue.
It's true.
So yeah, so you're like, all right, I live alone in New York City. I work a lot.
Yeah.
My readers are very different sort of set of people.
They're cooking more than I am.
Families so often.
I want to save some money. And also it was just about, I feel good in the kitchen. I wanted to feel that more. I felt a little bit anxious. I always feel a little bit anxious.
Yeah.
I feel a lot anxious. And I noticed, okay, well, I feel calmer in the kitchen, so why don't I just try to stay here in 2000, whatever that was, 16.
So if I had been in your shoes, I would have just said to myself, I need to cook more.
Or go to therapy.
Yeah, or both. Right. You, however...
I'm in therapy, by the way. A lot. I mean...
Kel Shock.
Sorry.
but then where did this notion of like, oh, going from I need to cook more to I'm going to cook 3 meals a day for essentially 30 straight days. That's a big leap. That's a chasm.
I know. And I wish, it put me in a situation where now I have to do this every January. And it's actually so far... This year it's been pretty easy because I've been doing it for 4 years, but I don't think it necessarily had to be 3 times a day for 31 days.
But where did that idea come from?
I guess it just came from ignorance, thinking that would be easy, that would not be difficult. And also just it just had a nice completion date on it, or like it was just a nice...
It was a finite
thing.
Cook 90s.
A week seemed sort of weak.
Yeah. So, all right. So you came up with the idea. So, and you said about it, and you've written about this the last few years on Epicurious. You have a hashtag. You share it on social media.
Spread like wildfire.
The readers liked it. You
became famous. Was elected senator. Yeah. Okay.
All right. To play devil's advocate here, one thing that sort of I feel is very American, if you will, is that we kind of go to extremes. It's either we're all or nothing. We're either drinking too much or we're doing dry January. And I'm going to drink too much, spend too much money on alcohol, and drink too much for 11 months a year, and then 1 month a year I'm not going to drink at all. Like, well, why not just sort of moderate your alcohol consumption or your sort of, indulgent, your ice cream consumption year-round instead of just taking off an entire month?
I think that when you do high-intensity interval cooking or high-intensity interval
abstaining,
it really does make an impact. And what I found is that by doing this, you know, very intensely for a month, with no delusions that I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, I know it's just going to be 1 month. So I can get, so it's easy to get through. But when I do it for 1 month, I do learn a lot about how to fit cooking into my life. And then at the end of the month, I can just like take what I want to take and leave the rest out.
Yeah. So what are the residual effects of having done the Cook 90 a couple of times now? Yeah. What do you do those other 11 months of the year that you sort of learn by those intensive 30-day stretches?
Yeah. So one thing I know about myself is that lunch is the hardest thing for me. Mm-hmm. I can do breakfast is fine. I wake up early. I can do breakfast. I can do dinner. It's fine. But it's really about lunch. It's hard for me to bring a good lunch. That's why I'm spending so much time in the cafeteria or going out here. But it's also the most expensive thing. It drives me crazy how much money it takes to buy lunch around this area, and probably everywhere in America, although in New York, Tribeca is probably more expensive than most. But I'm spending like $16 a day on a sandwich and a cookie from like that Olive's place, which is pretty decent, but like that's ridiculous.
Have you tabulated in your Cook 90 months how much money you save approximately?
No, and I will say, well, yes, in years past I have.
Yeah.
I definitely saved money, but it's not like a huge amount of money because you still have to buy all that food.
You're still spending
groceries.
Money. Yeah.
But what it is that, you know, so you save a little bit of money on lunch, you save a lot of money if you're not eating dinners. But also the thing I realized, my biggest takeaway is, okay, A, lunch is hard. I got to work hard on that. But also B, if I have done my grocery shopping, if I do it all at once, one day a week, that I'm so much more relaxed and cooking is so much easier. And I know that maybe sounds obvious, but a lot of people like me will like decide what they want to eat and then, you know, stop by the grocery store on the way home, and then they get home and then it's like 8 o'clock. Yeah. And I'm not eating till 9 o'clock.
So let's talk about this, how you set up the book, because all right, there's the notion of whether or not people are going to
Let's talk about what the first thing in the book.
Okay.
My
introduction.
Yes. Don't pretend like you're not part of this book. It's signed and everything. It was a great, let me just take this moment to publicly say, the best foreword of any cookbook in 2018. We haven't seen 2019 yet. We don't know, maybe 2019 too. But definitely getting a Beard Award for that foreword.
Thank God. I'm pretty sure it's the only foreword I've read of a cookbook in 2018. But, you talk about setting up that if the reader is going to embark on this Cook 90, cooking three meals a day, essentially for 30 straight days, you get three off days, but you have some building blocks. And you talk about meal plans, next overs, the big shop.
Right.
Meal plan first in terms of actually mapping out those weeks. How do you advise someone does that, and what's the upside of that?
Yeah. Everything stems from the meal plan. The rest of everything you cook and everything you shop, the shopping list, it all stems from the meal plan. So I do think that's the first thing you have to do. And I advise that you sit down and you make a grid, a 3x7 grid, and you know your day is at the top, and breakfast, lunch, dinner prep on along the side, and that you think about what you have going on that week. So like, you know, I go to a lot of opera and music, so you know I'll put in, that's the first thing I'll do, be like, okay, Wednesday night I'm going to the Met, so I have to have something that I can eat really quickly or that I can either take to work and eat there before I go.
That won't get your tuxedo dirty?
Right, my tuxedo, right. I change. Anna Winter and I change here in the podcast studio, and then we go together in her car. So I put down, you know, what your weeks are, so you can really understand, like, where do I actually have time to do good cooking this week, and where do I have only time to have good fast cooking? And then you can kind of put in your next overs. And the next over is where you, so for instance, tonight I'm making the cover recipe of the book, which is a sweet potato with chorizo and mushrooms and this limey yogurt. Instead of roasting just two sweet potatoes, which is what we will eat in my household tonight, I will roast six because I will then have the other four on hand for Thursday night when Claire Saffitz is coming over and we're going to have curry. And I'm going to have chickpea curry, which is from canned chickpeas, and the sweet potatoes have already been roasted. So all I have to do is cut those up and throw them in the curry at the last minute and let them warm through instead of spending the 30 minutes to have them cook in the curry.
I feel like you're underselling next overs. You just said next overs. Like, yeah. Talk to us about next overs.
Well, that's the concept. The next over is based on the idea that when you cook daily or when you cook a lot, one meal kind of informs the next. And if you're always thinking ahead, then cooking becomes a lot easier because basically,
and if you have that, and if you have that meal plan, it's easier to think ahead because you can say Tuesday I'm making this. Okay, Thursday I'm going to pencil in the chickpea curry with sweet potatoes, and you can see it all in front of you.
You can see it all, and you know when basically you're looking at. Okay, when is my oven going to be turned to 425?
Yeah,
and what can I get in there to prep ahead? Okay, when am I cooking rice or any grain, and you know, how many cups should I throw in there? Because I'm going to eat it that night, but then I can also use it for my lunches the next
night. Okay, yeah. So if I'm making some sort of rice-based dinner, I should be thinking, how can this rice play into lunch 2 days from now or tomorrow?
Exactly.
I'll double the amount of rice I'm making, or it could turn into some sort of rice soup sort of chicken thing on Thursday, et cetera.
Right. That's how daily cooking works. If you're trying to cook from scratch, meaning you're trying to start every night with a brand new set of raw ingredients that you've shopped for that day, you'll never become a frequent cook because that's difficult.
My problem is also a lot of stuff goes bad in your refrigerator because you're not planning ahead. You only use half a head of broccoli or whatever, and then it wilts, and by the time you All right, so you have the meal plan. You're thinking ahead. You've got next overs. Within that meal plan, you're slotting in various recipes from the book, which have next overs in mind. Mm-hmm. They're cookable.
Yeah.
We're going to get to some of the recipes. But then on Sunday, say, or Saturday or whatever, you then have to go shop for all of those ingredients at once, correct? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying, yeah. And so, for example, on Saturday, I got my delivery of groceries. Now, I do grocery delivery, and I think that's a huge time saver.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a big fan, although it's not perfect because, you know, they don't always have everything, and sometimes they give you stuff that's in bad shape, and you have to get your
I like to feel the produce.
So I do recommend that you either get your groceries delivered, you know, all at once, or you hopefully maybe you have like a minivan and you go to the grocery store and stock it up.
But you're looking at each recipe with the ingredient list and sort of just inputting those amounts or whatever, or thinking next over. That is a fair amount of foresight, and whether or not you're going to do two sweet potatoes or six and deciding there.
Yeah. Well, you're deciding that in the meal plan. So you're saying, okay, well, I'm going to eat two sweet potatoes on Tuesday and four on Thursday. So then you're just, once you've made your meal plan, you can just like add it up. Okay, six potatoes. It does take time. Look, and this is something I feel sort of, I was going to say annoyed. I'm not annoyed, but I feel a little passionate about lately. Is this idea that cooking shouldn't take time. It's a very basic thing that we have to do for ourselves. It's like feeding ourselves, hunting and gathering food. This is something we've done for a long time. And, you know, we think about it, you know, the way now compared to Neanderthals, we do it much quicker. But like this idea that we have to do it, it has to take 10 minutes, or that it should take 10 minutes, either the cooking should take 10 minutes, or
I will
the shopping
that is
be,
one of the
that
most
is insane to me.
Annoying things of the publishing industry, of which I've been part of in the last however many years, like easy 15-minute meals. Like, it's like, really? Like, no meal is actually 15 minutes.
That's true. No, that is actually true. No, and on Epic, we have 22-minute meals, and I've never been able to make one in 23 minutes. But, it's also, we shouldn't be perpetuating this idea that cooking, you should only spend 15 minutes on
cooking. Takes time, and cleaning up takes time.
Yeah, but it should, and why shouldn't it? And what else are you going to spend that time doing?
Yes.
Like, I'm really curious, and I know the people listening are like, well, you don't have kids, David Tamarkin. And so those people would say, well, you don't know me. Maybe I do have a kid out there somewhere. But you're right. I don't have a kid living with me.
Yes.
Sometimes my boyfriend acts like a child and I have to, take care of him. But anyway, so yeah, maybe if I had little kids running around, well, you would know. I mean, do kids like take so much time? You can only have 15 minutes for dinner?
Yeah, no, kids take time, but it depends what they're doing. What age? I mean, that's a wide range. Are they old enough to be doing homework on their own? Are they playing Xbox? Are they, you know, hanging on you? So yeah, kids definitely factor in. What I like also about the book, though, making a game plan, which I enjoy, you've got the shopping list, you've got sort of next overs plotted out. You also talk about having like your pantry and your freezer sort of in order for cooking. You know, but the notion of cooking, so much of the ethos of this book is getting in the kitchen and cooking. It is not getting in the kitchen and making everything from scratch with your sourdough starter and fermented, you know, homemade kimchi and whatnot. It's like, it's okay. You have a whole section on rotisserie chicken. Like, go out and buy a rotisserie chicken, but with that rotisserie chicken, you can make a green curry, this or that. You can make a Cobb salad sort of deal. It's like, you can have helpers. You can have a head start.
Yeah. I think that people should think of rotisserie chicken the same way that we do a can of sardines or tofu or tuna. I mean, there are plenty of fully cooked proteins that we feel completely comfortable just grabbing and incorporating into our cooking. Rotisserie chicken, I feel, has a little bit more of a stigma to it, or maybe not a stigma, but just people aren't as imaginative about it. They just go home and they eat the rotisserie chicken, which is perfectly fine. Although the problem is most rotisserie chickens in grocery stores don't really taste that great, and they're dried out. Mm-hmm. They've been there for a while. So I, you know, so at Epi, we've developed all these recipes for getting a little moisture back into the chicken, like braising it or just pulling it and throwing it like in some enchiladas. It's a great tool. And definitely, I think that there's no shame. I don't think there's any shame in anybody's cooking as long as they're cooking. I don't care what you do. I don't care what you want to start with, a skillet sauce or rotisserie chicken. I don't care. But I do think you should be just doing the cooking. I don't think you should be always eating something that's been prepared for you.
You have another recipe, which I like a lot, Vietnamese style pork patty salad with rice noodles, mm-hmm. in which you very candidly say in the intro, Italian sausage is definitely not Vietnamese, but when you fortify it with big hits of ginger, scallion, lime zest, and fish sauce, you'd never know it. And you're just taking Italian pork sausages, casings removed, forming them into little patties, grilling them up, and then you've got this rice noodle salad with some fresh cucumbers and mint and whatnot, and it's like, oh, like, that looks delicious.
And it's so, and rice noodles take no time. Yeah. It's just like tap literally, water, right?
Yeah. Literally no time.
Literally 15 minutes. Yeah, Italian sausage, I feel like I see that used a lot in Epi NBA, like in meatballs and meatloaf. It's such so much flavor in that Italian sausage, so why not use it? And that recipe, by the way, was done by Mindy Fox, who helped me. She threw a few recipes in here for me.
So
she's awesome.
How do you think people are going to use this book?
Okay, I think some people are cooking along with me right now. Right now, I'm cooking through all the meal plans. So there are 4 weeks of meal plans in the book.
What's your Instagram handle, if we want to follow?
It's just David Tamarkin.
Okay.
Yeah, Tamarkin. Mm-hmm. As if you guys didn't know. As if you're not following already. So a few people I think are going to actually do Cook 90. I think very, very few people will do Cook 90 exactly how I've laid it out to do in the book, and that's okay because that's not really the point. A big part of Cook 90 is that you eat whatever you want. And I'm not telling you how you should eat. I'm not telling you should avoid carbs or avoid sugar. I love sugar. I love fat. I love carbs. And I just think that this is in some ways a health plan because cooking is healthy just in all these different ways, but there's no restrictions. So it's sort of designed to be very, very flexible. What I think will happen is people will use this book and they will cook a lot. These are very cookable weeknight recipes, and I think they'll just dip in and cook from it. And maybe they'll do Cook 90 once in a while. Maybe they'll do a week and say, I'm going to cook 90 this week, which would be like cook 21, but whatever. Who's counting?
You are. yeah, I mean, there's no way in hell I would ever do Cook 90, but
Thank you for your support. Did you write that in the foreword? I missed that line.
That was in a little like a footnote. But I do think what is potentially really useful about this book are those takeaway, those, can you instill those habits in terms of someone being like, all right, I'm not going to cook 7 nights a week, but you know what? I am going to make a meal plan because I know I'm going to be home Tuesday night, Thursday night, and Sunday night. And I'm going to shop accordingly. And I'm going to take that tenet of next over so my Tuesday and Thursday meals sync up. And then I know lunch-wise, I've got a lunch date, I think, on Wednesday, and I've got an annoying meeting on Friday. But Thursday lunch, I can bring my lunch. And can you do that sort of cook 11 each week instead of cook 21.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you can accomplish that, that's, again, like, I think that's more useful than cooking intensively for 1 month. Can you apply those tenets 12 months a year?
Yeah. And that gets back to your question before of like, why make this a challenge? Why make it a 30-day thing and do it so intensively in one month? The hope is that that's what, at the end of that month, that's what you do. You take all these things you learned, you kind of get meal planning and, you know, big shops and next overing in your blood a little bit, and you take it with you for the rest of the year.
Okay, your boyfriend.
Yeah.
What's his name again?
Brian.
All right, Brian. Ever since you and I last chatted.
So many people just got depressed because they're like, oh, David sounds so hot. He sounds so single. He'd be so fun to date. He's got this glamorous job at Condé's biggest title. And now you just, you know, burst their bubbles.
Anyways, after I helped him move in with you,
yes.
What is his take when you go when you dig into January for Cook 90? Is he like, oh my God, we're doing this again, really, David? Or is he like, oh my God, it's amazing, so many meals being cooked for me? Be honest.
He hates Cook 90. He hates it. And in fact, we moved in with each other about this time last year, in December of last year, and so we got in, and I was like, nope, get out of the kitchen. Like, I have to do all this cooking. And it was a very rough transition. And later he told me, he's like, I think it was so rough because of Cook 90. And actually, he is leaving the country for most of the month. And I think it's because of Cook 90. And I'll just be cooking 90 for myself.
That is
and I
amazing.
Think the reason why he hates it so much is because he's an amazing cook. And he loves cooking as much as I do. And he doesn't want to be told what to cook. And he pretends to be vegetarian. So last night, pork tenderloin was on the meal plan. I was like, so I have to cook this. I have to Instagram this. I'm promoting the book. I am Cook 90. I am pork tenderloin tonight. And he was like, oh, fine, I'll eat it. But he's just not happy about it.
But you do make the point in the book that it's okay to cook with someone else. You don't have to make everything by yourself. You don't have to make everything with scratch. Yeah, as long as you're in the kitchen cooking, you can still tag team, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's better that way.
Yeah. Well, apparently he doesn't.
Right, right. I mean, sometimes I want to cook by myself and just have my own moment and listen to NPR and hopefully hear myself and Adi talking on NPR. That's always the best, right? When you're like, hear yourself on NPR while you're cooking. Yeah, I think it could be really isolating if you were to do the whole month of cooking by yourself. I think that'd be pretty rough, pretty bleak.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. All right, David Tamarkin, you can find his new cookbook, Cook 90, The 30-Day Plan for Faster, Healthier, Happier Meals, by David and the editors of Epicurious, in bookstores and Amazon and all that right now. Yep. And you can follow you on Instagram.
Right.
At David Tamarkin. Yeah.
Hit me up. Send me a message. I respond. My DMs are open, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to be lonely starting January 20th.
Exactly. Yeah. David's single for the next like 10 days or so. Anyways, thanks, David.
Thank you. You were so nice to me this time.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.